Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolf. The hotter it gets, the more zucchini there are. What to do with it all? We'll talk. And because summer often reminds us of childhood, we'll go back with some listeners who remember what their mothers made this time of year. Then we'll take a look at the environmental impact of all that seasonal produce. So let's dig in. Julie O'Hara is a freelance writer and recipe developer in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and she blogs at A Mingling of Tastes. She suffers from zucchini envy and has written about it for NPR's Kitchen Window Online. She joins me today. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Bonnie.
Is zucchini envy too strong?
I don't think so. Not at all. I mean, I actually suffer a lot of envy from anyone who can grow any fresh food in their own garden, because I live in a condo and I would love to have a garden someday and more zucchini than I know what to do with.
So where do you go to get your zucchini?
Usually I have to go to my local supermarket. If I can go to a farmer's market, I prefer that because you'll find so many great varieties of summer squash at farmer's markets.
What's your favorite of the summer squashes?
I like the patty pans because they're cute.
They are adorable.
They're the little round ones with, you know, scallops, kind of a lacy edge, and they're just cute. But most of the time I eat zucchini.
Now, why of all the overabundance of summer produce is squash the one you focus on?
I focus on squash because people complain about it so much, maybe I feel the need to champion it a little bit. And the reason they complain about it is because it's so prolific. You have a squash plant in your garden, you're going to have barrels and barrels of squash to last you all summer, and you're probably going to end up trying to give it away to friends and neighbors because it's more than you can use.
Why is it so prolific?
It just grows really easily. It's a happy plant. It's an ancient crop native to North America, and there's wild squash remains that date back to 7,000 BC, but it was domesticated in North America, and when the Native Americans migrated around North America, they took the squash with them, and it grew everywhere they planted it. It's just an easy crop to grow. It matures very quickly, so once you see the flowers on there, you're going to have a squash that's ready to pick in about a week.
Tell me about squash blossoms.
I love squash blossoms, and I didn't give any recipes for them because they're really hard to find. I rarely see them. If they're at a farmer's market, I'm thrilled, but they're hard to find unless you grow the plants yourself. And they're just the flower of the plant, and if it's a female squash blossom, it will turn into a squash, and if it's a male, it's there for pollination purposes, and you can pick the males and you can saute them in olive oil and toss them with pasta. You can stuff them with ricotta cheese. You can deep fry them. They're just delicious. They're an edible flower.
And yeah, talk about pretty.
Mm-hmm.
What are some other summer squashes that we may not be familiar with?
I love the eight ball squash. It's a great name, first of all, yeah, because it looks like, you know, a pool ball. Or sometimes they're called globe squash, and they're great for stuffing. And I mean, just picture the presentation on that. You know, you can stuff it with sausage, ground meat, vegetables, top it off with cheese, and it's a great little main course. There are really pretty striated yellow squash, you know, like with yellow and green stripes. There's pale green ones that are just minty green and white. There are so many varieties, I hesitate to give names because you just, you know, go to your market and see what looks good and try it.
Saraya Mohammed, who is the producer of this podcast, was away on vacation for 9 days and came back to find giant zucchini in her garden. What should she do with them?
Oh, that is the perfect illustration of what can happen if you're not careful and vigilant about your squash, because they grow so quickly, and if they get too large, then they lose their tenderness and the soft texture, and you can either pick them off and use them, you know, sort of as compost, or, and this is probably a better option, you can grate them and use them in squash bread, muffins, or pancakes. I have a recipe for pancakes on Kitchen Window, and they're also good for stuffing and roasting. Because when they get large, the skin gets firm and the seeds get big and they're not as tender and sweet as the young squash.
Well, in her defense, she did tell her house sitter to pick them when they were small, but apparently that didn't happen. So she'll be happy to hear this. One of the recipes that you use, I just loved. I had never thought of this, but it was to take a vegetable peeler and first peel the squash, but then use the vegetable peeler to make ribbons of squash to put in pasta, and I guess you could use it with other things.
Right. I love that technique, and it's great because there's no cooking involved unless you want there to be. But yeah, you just take the squash and you peel long ribbons along the length of the squash, and the texture you create is just great. It's got a little bit of toothsome crispness to it, but otherwise it's just this soft ribbon-like piece of squash, and you can toss it with pasta, you can toss it with olive oil and lemon just to make a salad, and it's beautiful. It's a beautiful presentation. It would be great as a bed for grilled fish, maybe. A million things you could do with it.
Maybe Soraya can use her big squash to do that. All right, Julie, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was food writer Julie O'Hara. Our mothers knew what to do with all those fruits and vegetables. At least it seemed that way. NPR's Michelle Norris talks with some listeners about favorite summer recipes.
Wanda Wong's favorite summer food is her mother's barbecue sauce. It's made with Heinz catsup, garlic, and salted brown beans, a Chinese staple, plus some other ingredients. It's sweet and savory, mellow and pungent, a bit different than your standard barbecue sauce. Wanda wanted to learn how to cook like her mother, and that endeavor was a bit of a challenge.
My mother immigrated to the U.S. in 1948, and she had to teach herself how to cook. And she always trusted her own instincts and her own sense of taste. And she had this way of measuring all the food. She'd use, like, her fingers when she's telling me. She'd say something like, "You use a finger of garlic." And I'd wonder, "Well, which finger?" And she never wrote any of her recipes down. And if she had, they would have been in Chinese anyway, which I can't read. But that's how she cooked. Then one summer, after my mom died, my husband and I went to a friend's house for an intimate potluck barbecue. We brought the ribs, and I made my mom's sauce. But I was worried that my friends wouldn't like it. It turns out I had nothing to worry about at all, because they loved it. And then they were asking me for a recipe, and I said, "Well, have you got a pen?" So what you do is you start out with a fingerful of garlic, and then we go from there.
No need to get out a pen. You can go to our website and find that recipe. But first, preparation is key to our next summer food that comes to us from Mary Carol Battle of St. Petersburg, Florida, who, by the way, celebrates her birthday this Friday.
Growing up, my best friend and I celebrated many of our birthdays together. When it came time to sing happy birthday, her mother always placed a huge, beautifully decorated store-bought cake in front of her, while my mother placed a wacky cake in front of me. Looks might count for something, but everyone always came back to the wacky cake for seconds.
Mary Carol Battle is with us now. Mary, I am intrigued. What makes this cake so wacky?
Well, I had to ask my mother. It's just the pure simplicity of it is why it's called wacky cake. It's just all poured into one pan, mixed up and thrown in the oven.
What are the ingredients?
I have the recipe right here. 1.5 cups flour, 1 cup sugar, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1/4 cup cocoa, and 1 teaspoon baking soda. You sift that and mix it up and make 3 holes. In the first hole, you put 1 teaspoon vanilla. In the second hole, 1 tablespoon of white vinegar. And in the third hole, 6 tablespoons of cooking oil or salad oil.
Vinegar?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry, that one stopped me, but just keep going.
Then you pour 1 cup of cold water over the whole thing and just stir it up. And if it's in the pan that you're going to bake it in, just pop it in the oven at 350 degrees for about 30 minutes.
And what's it look like?
Oh, it's chocolate cake to die for.
Really? Frosting or no frosting?
Well, we always use the 7-minute frosting, which is actually harder to make than the cake. But it's a delicious kind of marshmallowy, sugary topping that just is wonderful.
I'm stuck on the vinegar. Why that ingredient? What does that do?
I don't know.
Is that the secret to this?
I don't know, but it just gives it a slight tang, but it's still really good and chocolatey.
Now, when I heard you do your reading and you described your friend and her mother, I can imagine what that store bought cake looked like with little rosettes on it and probably some sort of Technicolor frosting. What I heard from you was a real expression of pride.
Oh, yes.
For your mother's wacky cake.
Yeah, they're just always delicious, and I hope she makes me one for my birthday.
Well, Mary Carol, thank you very much for introducing us to the wacky cake.
You're very welcome.
That was Mary Carol Battle of St. Petersburg, Florida, talking about wacky cakes. That recipe and the recipe for the 7-minute frosting that she talked about is at our website, npr.org. And we want to say thank you for all the folks who took the time to share their summer food stories. And summer's not over, so go forward and eat well.
That was NPR's Michelle Norris. We don't just worry about how summer's abundant produce affects our meal planning. These days, we also worry about how it affects our planet. A California company is trying to put us on a low-carb diet, as in low carbon emissions. NPR's Alex Cohen reports.
It's lunchtime at the headquarters of the online auction company eBay. At first glance, the Silicon Valley lunchroom looks like any run-of-the-mill cafeteria. Sandwich bar over here, hot daily special over there, pizza station in the middle. But head chef Bob Clark points out these are not your run-of-the-mill pepperoni pies.
We've got a fresh fruit pizza, dried Bing cherries and peaches, caramelized fennel.
There's a reason why these pizzas are covered with local produce instead of mozzarella. It's all part of the low-carbon diet that's being launched at 400 cafes and cafeterias run by Bon Appetit. Helene York likes to call herself the architect of this diet, which looks at the entire life cycle of each food item. Take cheese, York says. Most cheeses come from animals that eat feed, which is a carbon-intensive product.
The cow eats the feed. The milk is processed and transported in refrigerated trucks. If it comes from a long distance, it's put on an airplane.
Airplanes emit a lot of CO2. And then there's the end of cheese's life cycle. Leftovers wind up in a landfill where they release methane, a greenhouse gas which York says is 23 times more potent than carbon dioxide. That's why, York says, Bon Appetit chefs have been told to reduce their cheese and beef purchases, and that's just the first step.
They are required to eliminate bottled waters from overseas. They are required to reduce food waste. They are required to do energy and water audits to reduce the carbon emissions associated with cooking the food.
Bon Appetit officially unveils their diet today, but chefs have been putting its principles into practice for the past year. For chefs like eBay's Bob Clark, that's meant making some changes and using food creatively. For instance, to avoid sending leftover fruit to the landfill, he freezes it for later use.
You need to plan ahead. You need to think like a squirrel.
There are benefits of the low-carbon diet that go beyond the environmental ones, Clark says. With food costs on the rise, cutting back on beef, dairy, and processed foods can reduce costs. And he adds, low-carbon items from local farmers tend to make the best meals.
As a chef, you're always trying to get the freshest ingredients. And the more times people handle it, store it, move it, it really loses its flavor.
Chefs might be on board with the low-carbon diet, but Bon Appetit will have to convince its diners, too. The company runs lunchrooms at museums, corporations, and campuses like Mills College in Oakland, California.
You want anything? Yes, please.
Melissa McDonough is a junior here and says she's noticed a lot of changes since Bon Appetit took over their cafeteria, not all of them good.
There's a lot of placards telling you to eat green and be environmental, but the taste and freshness of the food seems lackluster.
The steamed vegetable, she says, tasted more like gym socks. And once she got a salad that was frozen solid. Helene York, designer of the low-carbon diet, takes these comments in stride and recognizes there are kinks to work out throughout the program. They're still figuring out ways to turn food waste into compost on-site. And then there's that pesky problem of rice.
Rice is traditionally grown with animal manure spread over paddies, flooded with water, and it's the water that causes the methane from the manure to be released into the atmosphere.
But York says they have made progress so far. Their goal for this year was to reduce meat purchases by 10%. So far, they've cut back by nearly 20%. And she says you can't do that unless you offer tastier alternatives to the average burger. Alex Cohen, NPR News.
Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and recipes. Join us next time for a bowl of cool summer soup. I'm Bonnie Wolfe.